The occult? I could not imagine what she meant. Seances? Ouija boards? Madame Blavatsky? Planchettes?
No, they're more serious than that. They belong to an order.
I was stunned. I had fallen into an abyss. I envisioned Satanism, covens, California lunacy at its worst. She read my face and said,
I'm not in it myself. I just know them.
What is the name of the order?
XXX.
But, I leaned forward, scarcely believing that I had heard correctly. It can't be XXX. Zala?
Zala, Zalior, Zalati.
I felt disbelief, shock. I felt a surprised fear, looking at her beautiful face. XXX was more than a group of California screwballs dressing themselves in robes. They were frightening. They were known to be cruel, even savage. They'd had some minor connection with the Manson family, and that was the only reason I had read about them. After the Manson affair, they were supposed to have gone elsewhere, to Mexico, I thought. Were they still in California? From what I had read, Alma would have been better off knowing button men in the Mafia. From the Mafia, you would expect the motives, rational or not, of our phase of capitalism. The XXX was raw material for nightmares. And those people are your friends? I asked.
You asked.
I shook my head, still astonished.
Don't worry about it, or about them. You'll never see them.
It gave me an entirely different picture of her life. Sitting across from me, faintly smiling, she was, for a moment, sinister. It was as though I had stepped off a sunlit path into jungle, and I thought of Helen Kayon working on Scott's Chaucerians in the library.
Even I don't see them all that much, she said.
But you've been to their meetings? You go to their houses? She nodded.
I said, they're my friends, but don't worry about it.
It could have been a lie, another lie, for I thought she had not always been truthful with me. But her entire manner, even her concern for my feelings, demonstrated that she was being truthful. She raised her cup of coffee to her lips, smiling at me with a trace of concern, and I saw her standing before a fire, holding a bleeding something in her hands.
You are worrying about it. I'm not a member. I know people in it. You asked me, and I thought you should know.
Have you been to meetings? What goes on?
I can't tell you. That is just another part of my life. A small part. It won't touch you.
Let's get out of here, I said. Was I thinking, even then, that she would give me material for a novel? I do not think so. I thought that her contact with the group was probably much slighter than she had suggested. I had only one hint, much later, that it may not have been. She was romancing, exaggerating, I told myself. The XXX and Virginia Woolf? And La Grande Illusion? It was very far-fetched. Sweetly, almost teasingly, she invited me back to her apartment. It was a short walk from the coffee house. As we left the busy street and turned into a darker area of tall houses, she began to talk inconsequentially of Chicago and her life there. For once, I did not have to question her to get information about her past. I thought I could detect a glancing relief in her voice. Because she had confessed her acquaintance with the XXX? Or was it because I had not quizzed her about it? The latter, I thought. It was a typical late summer Berkeley evening, somehow warm and chilly at once, cold enough for a jacket, but with a sense of hidden warmth in the texture of the air. Despite the unpleasant surprise she had given me, the young woman beside me, her unconscious grace, her equally natural wit which lay embedded in her talk, her rather unearthly beauty, enlivened me, made me happier for life than I had been in months. Being with her was like coming out of hibernation. We reached her building.
"Ground floor," she said,
and went up the steps to the door. For the pleasure of looking at her, I hung back. A sparrow lighted on the railing and cocked its head. I could smell leaves burning. She turned around, and her face was washed into a pale blur by the shadows of the porch. Somewhere in the neighborhood, a dog barked. Miraculously, I could still see her eyes, as if they shone like a cat's.
"Are you as circumspect as your novel, or are you going to come in with me?"
I simultaneously recorded the fact that she had read my book and the Featherlight criticism of it, and went up the steps to the door. I had not imagined what her apartment would be like, but I should have known that it would be nothing like Helen Kayon's untidy menage. Alma lived alone, but that I had suspected. Everything in the large room into which she brought me was unified by a single taste, a single point of view. It was, though not obviously, one of the most luxurious private rooms I have ever seen. A long, thick Bokhara rug lay over the floor. A painted fire screen was flanked by tables, which looked to my untrained eye to be Chippendale. A vast desk was placed before the bay window. Striped Regency chairs, big cushions, a Tiffany lamp on the desk. I saw that I had been right to think that her parents were moneyed. I said, "You're not the typical grad student, are you?"
"I decided it was more sensible to live with these things than to put them in storage. More coffee?"
I nodded. So much about her now made sense, fit a pattern I hadn't seen before. If Alma was remote, it was because she was genuinely different. She had been raised in a manner that 90% of America never sees, and in which it only provisionally believes, the manner of the bohemian ultra-rich. And if she was essentially passive, it was because she had never had to make a decision for herself. On the spot, I invented a childhood of nursemaids and nannies, schooling in Switzerland, holidays on yachts. That, I thought, explained her air of timelessness. It was why I had imagined her flying past the Plaza Hotel in the Fitzgerald 20s. That kind of wealth seemed to belong to another age. When she came back in with the coffee, I said, "How would you like to take a trip with me in a week or two? We could stay in a house in Still Valley." Alma raised her eyebrows and cocked her head. It struck me that there was an androgynous quality to her passivity, just as there is, perhaps, an androgynous quality to a prostitute. "You're an interesting girl," I said.
"A Reader's Digest character?"
"Hardly." She sat, her knees drawn up, on a fat cushion before me. She was strongly sexual and ethereal at once, and I dismissed the notion of her being somehow androgynous. It seemed impossible that I had just thought it. I knew that I had to sleep with her. I knew I would, and the knowledge made the act even more imperative. "Just put your money on the table, boy." By morning, my infatuation was total. Going to bed had taken place in the most understated manner possible. After we had spent an hour or two talking, she had said,
"You don't want to go home, do you?"
"No."
"Well then, you'd better stay here tonight."
What followed was not just the ordinary limping round of the body, lust's three-legged race. In fact, She was as passive in bed as in all else. Yet she had effortless orgasms, first during the minuet stage, and then later during the hell-for-leather period. She clung to my neck like a child, while her hips bucked and her legs strained against my back. But even during this surrendering, she was separate.
"Oh, I love you,"
she said after the second time, gripping my hair in her fists. But the pressure of her hands was as light as her voice. Reaching one mystery in her, I found another mystery behind it. Alma's passion seemed to come from the same section of her being as her table manners. I had made love with a dozen girls who were better in bed than Alma Mobley, but with none of them had I experienced that delicacy of feeling, Alma's ease with shades and colors of feeling. It was like being perpetually on the edge of some other sort of experience, like being before an unopened door. I understood for the first time why girls fell in love with Don Juans, why they humiliated themselves pursuing them, and I knew that she had given me a highly selective version of her past. I was certain that she had been nearly as promiscuous as a woman could be. That fit in with the XXX, with a sudden departure from Chicago. Promiscuity seemed the unspoken element of Alma's mode of being. What I wanted, of course, was to supplant all the others, to open the door and witness all of her mysteries, to have the grace and subtlety directed entirely toward me. In a Sufi fable, the elephant fell in love with a firefly and imagined that it shone for no other creature but he. And when it flew long distances away, he was confident that at the center of its light was the image of an elephant. 3. Which is to say no more than that love cut me off at the knees. My notions of getting back to novel writing vanished. I could not invent feelings when I was so taken over by them myself. With Alma's enigma before me, the different enigma of fictional characters seemed artificial. I would do that, but I had to do this first. Thinking of Alma Mobley incessantly, I had to see her whenever I could. For 10 days I was with her almost every minute I was not teaching. Unread student stories piled up on my couch, matching the piles of essays about the Scarlet Letter on my desk. During this time, our sexual bravado was outrageous. I made love to Alma in temporarily deserted classrooms, in the unlocked office I shared with a dozen others. Once I followed her into a woman's lavatory in Sproul Hall and went into her as she balanced on a sink. A student in the creative writing class, after I had been very rhetorical, asked, "How do you define man, anyhow?" "Sexual and imperfect," I answered. I said that I spent almost every moment with her that I did not spend in class. The exceptions were 2 evenings when she said that she had to visit an aunt in San Francisco. She gave me the aunt's name, Florence DePizer. But while she was gone, I still sweated with doubt. The next day, however, she was back unaltered. I could see no traces of another lover, nor of the XXX, which was the greater worry. And she surrounded Mrs. DePizer with so much circumstantial detail, a Yorkshire terrier named Chucky, a closet full of Halston dresses, a maid named Rosita, that my suspicions died. You could not return from an evening with the sinister zombies of the XXX full of stories about a dog named Chucky. If there were other lovers, if the promiscuity I had sensed that first night still clung to her, I saw no sign of it. In fact, if one thing bothered me, it was not the hypothetical rivalry of another man, but a remark she had made during our first morning together. It might have been no more than an oddly phrased statement of affection.
"You have been approved," she said.
For a lunatic moment, I thought she meant by our surroundings, the Chinese vase on the bedside table and the framed drawing by Pissarro and the shag carpet. All of this made me more insecure than I recognized.
"So you approve," I said.
"Not by me. Well, of course by me, but not only by me."
Then she put a finger to my lips. Within a day or two, I had forgotten this irritatingly unnecessary mystery. Of course, I had forgotten my work, too, most of it. Even after the first frantically sensual weeks, I spent much less time on teaching than I had before. I was in love as I had never been. It was as though all my life I had skirted joy, looked at it askance, misunderstood it. Only Alma brought me face to face with it. Whatever I had suspected or doubted in her was burned away by feeling. If there were things I didn't know about her, I didn't give a damn. What I did know was enough. I am sure it was she who first brought up the question of marriage. It was in a sentence like, "When we're married, we ought to do a lot of traveling," or, "What kind of house do you want after we're married?" Our conversation slipped into these discussions with no strain. I felt no coercion, only an increase in happiness.
"Oh, you really have been approved," she said.
"May I meet your aunt some day?"
"Let me spare you," she said,
which did not answer the implied question.
"If we get married next year, let's spend the summer on the Greek islands. I have some friends we can stay with, friends of my father's who live on Poros."
"Would they approve of me too?"
"I don't care if they do or not," she said,
taking my hand and making my heart speed. Several days later, she mentioned that after we had visited Poros, she would like to spend a month in Spain.
"What about Virginia Woolf, your degree?"
"I'm not really much of a student."
Of course, I did not really imagine that we would spend months and months traveling, but it was a fantasy which seemed at least an image of our shared future, like the fantasy of my continued, unspecified approval. As the day of my Stephen Crane lecture for Lieberman drew nearer, I realized that I had done virtually no preparation, and I told Alma that I'd have to spend at least a couple of evenings at the library. It'll be an awful lecture anyhow. I don't care if Lieberman tries to get me another year here, because I think that we both want to get out of Berkeley. But I have to get some ideas together. She said that was fine, that she was planning to visit Mrs. DePizer anyhow for the next two or three nights. When we parted the next day, we gave each other a long embrace. Then she drove off. I walked back to my apartment, in which I had spent very little time during the previous month and a half, straightened things up, and went off to the library. On the library's ground floor, I saw Helen Kayon for the first time since she had left the lecture theater with Meredith Polk. She did not see me. She was waiting for an elevator with Rex Leslie, the instructor with whom I had swapped desks. They were deep in conversation, and while I glanced at them, Helen placed the flat of her hand on Rex Leslie's back. I smiled, silently wished her well, and went up the stairs. That night and the next, I worked on the lecture. I had nothing to say about Stephen Crane. I was not interested in Stephen Crane. Whenever I looked up from the pages, I saw Alma Mobley, her eyes glimmering and her mouth widening. On the second night of Alma's absence, I left my apartment to go out for a pizza and a beer, and saw her standing in the shadows beside a bar called The Last Reef.
It was a place I would have hesitated to enter, since by repute it was a haunt for bikers and homosexuals looking for rough trade. I froze. For a second, what I felt was not betrayal, but fear. She was not alone. And the man with her had obviously been in the bar. He carried a glass of beer, but was not apparently a biker or a gay in search of company. He was tall, and his head was shaven, and he wore dark glasses. He was very pale. And though he was dressed nondescriptly, in tan trousers and a golf jacket, over a bare chest, I thought I saw chains of some sort flattened against skin. The man looked animal, a hungry wolf in human skin. A small boy, exhausted and barefooted, sat on the pavement by his feet. The three of them were strikingly odd, grouped together in the shadows by the side of the bar. Alma seemed comfortable with the man. She spoke desultorily. He answered. They seemed closer than Helen Kayon and Rex Leslie, though there were no gestures of familiar warmth between them. The child slumped at the man's feet, shaking himself at times as though he feared to be kicked. The three of them looked like a perverse nighttime family, a family by Charles Adams. Alma's characteristic grace, her way of holding herself, seemed, beside the werewolf-like man and the pathetic child, unreal, somehow wicked. I backed away, thinking that if the man saw me, he would turn savage in an instant. For that is what a werewolf looks like, I thought, and then thought, the XXX. The man jerked the twitching boy off the pavement, nodded to Alma, and got into a car by the curbside, still holding his glass of beer. The boy crept into the back seat. In a moment, the car had roared off. Later that night, not knowing if I were making a mistake, but unable to wait until the next day, I telephoned her. "I saw you a couple of hours ago," I said. "I didn't want to disturb you. Anyhow, I thought you were in San Francisco."
"It was too boring, and I came back early. I didn't call because I wanted you to get your work done." "Oh, Don, you poor soul. You must have imagined something awful."
"Who was the man you were talking to? Shaven head, dark glasses, a little boy with him, alongside a biker's bar?"
"Oh, him. Is that who you saw me with? His name is Greg. We knew each other in New Orleans. He came here to go to school and then dropped out. The boy is his little brother. Their parents are dead, and Greg takes care of him, though I must say not very well. The boy is retarded."
"He's from New Orleans?"
"Of course."
"What's his last name?"
"Why? Are you suspicious? His last name is Benton. The Bentons lived on the same street as we did."
It sounded plausible, if I didn't think about the appearance of the man she was calling Greg Benton. "Is he in the XXX?" I asked. She laughed.
"My poor darling is all worked up, isn't he? No, of course he isn't. Don't think about that, Don. I don't know why I told you."
"Do you really know people in the XXX?" I demanded. She hesitated.
"Well, just a few."
I was relieved. I thought she was glamorizing herself. Maybe my werewolf really was just an old neighbor from New Orleans. In fact, the sight of him in the bar's shadows had reminded me of my first sight of Alma herself, standing colorless as a ghost on a shadowy campus staircase. "What does this Benton do?"
"Well, I think he has an informal trade in pharmaceuticals," she said.
Now that made sense. It suited his appearance, his hanging around a bar like the Last Reef. Alma sounded as close to embarrassment as I had ever heard her.
if you're through with your work, please come over and give your fiancé a kiss," she said.
I was out the door in less than a minute.
Two peculiar things happened that night. We were in Alma's bed, watched over by the objects I have already enumerated. I had been dozing more than sleeping for most of the night, and I reached over lightly to touch Alma's bare, rounded arm. I did not want to wake her, but it was as if her arm gave my fingers a shock. Not an electric shock, but a shock of concentrated feeling, a shock of revulsion, as though I had touched a slug. I snatched back my hand. She turned over and mumbled,
"All right, darling,"
and I mumbled something back. Alma patted my hand and went back to sleep. Sometime later, I dreamed of her. I saw merely her face, but it was not the face I knew, and the strangeness of it made me groan with anxiety. And for the second time I came wholly awake, not sure where I was or by whose side I lay.
4.
So that may be when the change began. But our relationship remained superficially as it had been, at least until the long weekend in Still Valley. We still made love often and happily. Alma continued to speak enchantingly of the way we would live after we married. And I continued to love her, even while I doubted the absolute veracity of some of her statements. After all, as a novelist, wasn't I too a kind of liar? My profession consisted of inventing things, and of surrounding them with enough detail to make them believable. A few inventions on someone else's part did not upset me unduly. We had decided to get married in Berkeley at the end of the spring semester, and marriage seemed a ceremonious seal to our happiness. But I think the change had already begun, and that my recoiling from the touch of her skin in the middle of the night was the sign that it had started weeks before without my seeing it. Yet a factor in the change was certainly the approval I had so mysteriously earned. I finally asked her about it outright on the morning of the Crane lecture. It was a tense morning for me, since I knew I was to do a bad job, and I said, "Look, if this approval you keep mentioning isn't yours, and if it isn't Mrs. DePeyser's, then whose is it? I can't help but wonder. It's not your friend in the drug trade, I suppose. Or is it his idiot brother?" She looked up, a bit startled. Then she smiled.
"I ought to tell you. We're close enough."
"We ought to be." She was still smiling.
"It's going to sound a little funny."
"I don't care. I'm just tired of not knowing."
"The person who has been approving of you is an old lover of mine. Wait, Don, don't look like that. I don't see him anymore. I can't see him anymore. He's dead."
"Dead?" I sat down. I sounded surprised, and I am sure I looked surprised, but I think that I had expected something of this order of weirdness. She nodded, her face serious and playful at once, the doubling effect.
"That's right. His name is Tasker Martin. I'm in touch with him."
"You're in touch with him?"
"Constantly."
"Constantly?"
"Yes. I talk with him. Tasker likes you, Don. He likes you very much."
"He's okayed me, as it were."
"That's right. I talk to him about everything. And he's told me over and over that we're right for each other. Besides that, he just likes you, Don. He'd be a good friend of yours if he were alive."
I just stared at her.
"I told you it would sound a little funny."
"It does." She lifted her hands.
"So?"
How long ago did... Tasker die?
Years ago. 5 or 6 years ago.
Another old New Orleans friend?
That's right.
And you were close to him?
We were lovers. He was older, a lot older. He died of a heart attack. 2 nights after that, he started to talk to me.
It took him 2 days to get change for the phones. She did not reply to this. Is he talking to you now?
He's listening. He's glad you know about him now.
I'm not so sure I'm glad I do.
Just get used to the idea. He really likes you, Don. It'll be all right. It'll be just the same as it was before.
Does Tasker pick up his phone when we're in bed?
I don't know. I suppose he does. He always liked that side of things.
And does Tasker give you some of your ideas about what we'll do after we get married?
Sometimes. It was Tasker that reminded me about my father's friends on Poros. He thinks you'll love the island.
And what does Tasker think I'm going to do now that you've told me about him?
He says you'll be upset for a little while and that you'll think I'm crazy for a while, but that you'll just get used to the idea. After all, he's here and he isn't going anywhere. And you're here, and we're going to be married. Don, just think about Tasker as though he were a part of me.
I suppose he must be, I said. I certainly can't believe that you're actually in communication with a man who died 5 years ago. In part, I was fascinated by all this. A 19th-century habit like talking with departed spirits suited Alma down to the ground. It harmonized even with her passivity. But also it was creepy. The talkative ghost of Tasker Martin was obviously a delusion. In the case of anybody but Alma, it would have been the symptom of mental illness. Creepy, too, was the concept of being okayed by former lovers. I looked across the table at Alma, who was regarding me with a kindly expression of expectancy, and thought, she does look androgynous. She could have been a pretty 19-year-old freckled boy. She smiled at me, still with expectation kindling in her face. I wanted to make love to her, and I also felt a separation from her. Her long, beautifully shaped fingers lay on the polished wood of her table, attached to hands and wrists equally beautiful. These, too, both attracted and repelled.
"We'll have a beautiful marriage," Alma said.
"You and me and Tasker."
"See? He said you'd be like that at first."
On the way to the lecture, I remembered the man I had seen her with, the Louisianian Greg Benton, with his dead, ferocious face, and I shuddered. For one sign of Alma's abnormality, one indication that she was no one else I had ever known, was that she suggested a world in which advisory ghosts and men who were disguised wolves could exist. I know of no other way to put this. I do not mean that she made me believe in the paraphernalia of the supernatural, but she suggested that such things might be fluttering invisibly about us. You step on a solid-looking piece of ground, and it falls away under your shoe. You look down, and instead of seeing grass, earth, the solidity you had expected, you are looking at a deep cavern where crawling things scurry to get out of the light. Well, so here is a cavern, a chasm of sorts, you say. How far does it go? Does it underlie everything? And is the solid earth merely a bridge over it? No, of course it is not. It very likely is not. I do love Alma, I told myself. We will be married next summer. I thought of her extraordinary legs, her fine, lovely face, of the sense I had with her that I was deep in a half-understood game. My second lecture was a disaster. I brought out second-hand ideas, unsuccessfully tried to relate them, and got lost in my notes. I contradicted myself. My mind on other things, I said that the red badge of courage was a great ghost story in which the ghost never appears. It was impossible to disguise my lack of preparation and interest in what I was saying. There were a few ironic hand claps when I left the podium. I was grateful that Lieberman was far away in Iowa. After the lecture, I went to a bar and ordered a double Johnny Walker Black. Before I left, I went to the telephones at the back and took out the San Francisco directory. I looked under P first and found nothing and started to sweat. But when I looked under D, I found DePizer, F. The address was in the right section of town. Maybe the earth was solid ground after all. Of course it was. The next day I rang David at his office and told him that I'd like to go to his place in Still Valley.
"Fantastic," he said. "And about time, too. I've got some people looking in to see that nobody steals anything. But I wanted you to use the place all along, Don."
"I've been pretty busy," I said. "How are the women out there?" "Strange and new," I said. "In fact, I think I'm engaged."
"You don't sound so sure about it."
"I'm engaged. I'm getting married next summer."
"What the hell's her name? Have you told anybody?"
"Wow! I've heard about being understated, but..." I told him her name. "David, I haven't told anybody else in the family. If you're in touch with them, say I'll be writing soon. Being engaged takes up most of my time." He told me how to get to his place, gave me the name of the neighbors who had the key, and said,
"Hey, little brother, I'm happy for you."
We made the usual promises to write. David had bought the Still Valley property when he had a job in a California law firm. With his usual sagacity, he had chosen the place carefully, making sure that the house he would have as a vacation home had plenty of land around it, 8 acres, and was close to the ocean, and then had spent all of his spare cash having the building completely renewed and redecorated. When he left for New York, he kept the place, knowing that property values in Still Valley were going to take off. The house had probably quadrupled in value since then, proving once again that David was no fool. After Alma and I picked up the keys from the painter and his pottery-making wife several miles down the valley road, we turned off onto a dirt road in the direction of the ocean. We could hear and smell the Pacific before we saw the house. And when Alma saw it, she said,
"Don, this is where we should come for our honeymoon."
I had been misled by David's constant description of the place as a cottage. What I expected was a 2- or 3-room frame building, probably with outdoor plumbing, a beer and poker shack. Instead, it looked just like what it was, the expensive toy of a rich young lawyer.
"Your brother just lets this place stay empty?" Alma asked.
"I think he comes here 2 or 3 weeks every year."
"Well..."
I had never before seen her impressed. "What does Tasker think?"
"He thinks it's incredible. He says it looks like New Orleans."
I should have known better. Yet the description was not inaccurate. David's cottage was a tall 2-story wooden structure, dazzling white and Spanish in conception, with black wrought-iron balconies outside the upper windows. Thick columns flanked the massive front door. Behind the house we could see the endless blue ocean, a long way down. I took our suitcases from the trunk of the car and went up the steps and opened the door. Alma followed. After going through a small, tiled vestibule, We were in a vast room where various areas were raised and others sunken. A thick white carpet rolled over it all. Massive couches and glass-topped tables stood in different areas of the room. Exposed beams had been polished and varnished across the width of the ceiling. I knew what I would find even before we inspected the house. I knew there would be a sauna and a jacuzzi and a hot tub, an expensive stereo system, a Cuisinart in the kitchen, a bookshelf filled with educational porn in the bedroom, and all this we found as we went through the house. Also a Betamax, a French bread rack serving as shelf space for Art Deco gewgaws, a bed the size of a swimming pool, a bidet in every bathroom. Almost immediately I felt trapped inside someone else's fantasy. I had no idea David had made so much money during his years in California. Neither had I known that his taste stayed on the level of a hustling young J.C.
"You don't like it, do you?" asked Alma.
"I'm surprised by it."
"What's your brother's name?"
I told her.
"And where does he work?"
She nodded when I named the firm, not as Rachel Varney would have done, with a detached irony, but as though she were checking the name against a list. Yet, of course, she was correct. I did not like David's Xanadu. Still, there we were. We had to spend 3 nights in the house, and Alma accepted it as if it were hers. But as she cooked in the gadget-laden kitchen, as she reveled in David's collection of expensive toys, I grew increasingly sour. I thought she had adapted to the house in some uncanny fashion, had subtly altered from the student of Virginia Woolf to a suburban wife. Suddenly I could see her stocking up on chip dip at the supermarket. Once again, I am compressing ideas about Alma into a single paragraph, but in this case I am condensing the impressions of 2 days, not 3 times that many months. And the change in her was merely a matter of degree. Yet I had the uneasy feeling that, just as in her apartment she was perfectly the embodiment of the bohemian rich girl, in David's house she threw off hints of a personality suited to jacuzzi baths and home saunas. She became more garrulous. The sentences about how we would live after our marriage became essays. I found out where we would make our base while we traveled, Vermont, how many children we would have, 3, on and on. And worse, she began to talk endlessly about Tasker Martin.
"Tasker was a big man, Don, and he had beautiful white hair and a strong face with the most piercing blue eyes. What Tasker used to like was... Did I ever tell you about Tasker's? One day, Tasker and I..."
This, more than anything, marked the end of my infatuation. But even then I found it difficult to accept that my feelings had changed. While she described the characters of our children, I would find myself mentally crossing my fingers, almost shuddering. Realizing what I was doing, I would say to myself, "But you're in love, aren't you? You can even put up with the fantasy of Tasker Martin, can't you? For her sake?" The weather made everything worse. Though we had had warm sunshine on the day we arrived, our first night in Still Valley was submerged in dark, dense fog that endured for the next 3 days. When I looked out the rear windows toward the ocean, it was as though the ocean were all around us, gray and deadening. Of course, this is what Saul Malkin imagines in his Paris hotel room with Rachel Varney. At times, you could see halfway down to the valley road, but at other times you saw about as far ahead as you could extend your arms. A flashlight in that damp grayness simply lost heart. Thus, There we are, mornings and afternoons in David's house, while gray fog slides past the windows and the noise of waves slapping the beach far down suggests that any minute water will begin to come in through the bottom of the door. Alma is elegantly curled on one of the sofas, holding a cup of tea or a plate with an orange divided into equal sections.
Tasca used to say that I'd be the most beautiful woman in America when I was 30. Well, I'm 25 now, and I think I'll disappoint him. Tasca used to...
What I felt was dread. On the second night, she rolled out of bed naked, waking me. I sat up in bed, rubbing my eyes in the gloom. Alma walked across the cold gray bedroom to the window. We had not closed the drapes, and Alma stood with her back to me, staring at nothing at all. The bedroom windows faced the ocean, but though we could hear the cold noises of water all through the night, the window revealed nothing but surging gray. I expected her to speak. Her back looked very long and pale in the murky room.
"What is it, Alma?" I asked.
She did not move or speak.
"Is anything wrong?"
Her skin seemed lifeless, white, cold marble.
"What happened?"
She turned very slightly toward me and said,
"I saw a ghost."
That, at any rate, is what Rachel Varney tells Saul Malkin. But did Alma actually say, "I am a ghost"? I could not be sure. She spoke very softly. I'd had more than enough of Tasker Martin, and my first response was a groan. But if she had said, "I am a ghost," would I have responded differently?
"Oh, Alma," I said, not as fed up as I would have been in the daytime.
The chill in the room, the dark window, and the girl's long white body, these made Tasker a more real presence than he had been. I was a little frightened.
"Tell him to go away," I said. "Come back to bed."
But it was no good. She picked her robe off the bed, put it around her, and sat down, turning her chair toward the window.
"Alma?"
She would not answer or turn around. I lay down again and finally went back to sleep. After the long weekend in Still Valley, things moved to their inevitable conclusion. I often thought that Alma was half mad. She never explained her behavior of that night, and after what happened to David, I wondered if all her actions comprised what I had once called a game, if she had been playfully, consciously manipulating my mind and feelings. Passive rich girl, terrorist of the occult, student of Virginia Woolf, semi-lunatic. She did not cohere. She continued to project us into our future, but after Still Valley I began to invent excuses for avoiding her. I thought that I loved her, but the love was overshadowed by dread. Tasker, Greg Benton, the zombies of the XXX. How could I marry all that? And then I felt a physical as well as a moral revulsion. Over the 2 months following Still Valley, we had generally ceased making love, though I sometimes spent the night in her bed. When I kissed her, when I held or touched her, I overheard my own thinking, "Not much longer." My teaching, except for rare flashes in the writing classes, had become remote and dull. I had stopped my own writing altogether. One day, Lieberman asked me to see him in his office, and when I arrived, he said, "One of your colleagues described your Stephen Crane lecture to me. Did you actually say that the Red Badge was a ghost story without a ghost?" When I nodded, he asked,
Would you mind telling me what that means?
I don't know what it means. My mind was wandering. My rhetoric got out of hand. He looked at me in disgust. I thought you made a good start, he said. And I knew there was no longer any question of my staying on another year. 5. Then Alma disappeared. She had forced me, as dependent people can force others to do as they wish, to meet her for lunch at a restaurant near the campus. I went, got a table, waited half an hour, and at last realized that she was not coming. I had been braced for more stories of what we were going to do in Vermont, and I was not hungry, but ate a salad out of general relief and went home. She did not call that night. I dreamed of her sitting in the prow of a small boat, drifting away down a canal and smiling enigmatically, as if giving me a day and a night of freedom was the last act of the charade. By morning, I had begun to worry. I telephoned her several times during the day, but either she was out or not answering the phone. This evoked a clear picture. A dozen times while I had been in her apartment, she had let the phone ring until it stopped. By evening, I had begun to imagine that I was really free of her, and I knew that I would do anything to avoid seeing her again. I telephoned twice more during the night and was happy to get no answer. Finally, I stayed up until 2, writing a letter, breaking it off. Before my first class, I went over to her building. My heart was beating fast. I was afraid I'd see her by accident and have to mouth the phrases, which were so much more convincing on paper. I went up the steps of her building and saw that the drapes were drawn over her windows. I pushed at the locked door. I almost pushed the bell. Instead, I slid the letter between the window and the frame, where she would see it, and the inscription, Alma, as soon as she came up the stairs. Then I, no other word for it, fled. Of course, she knew my teaching schedule, and I half expected to see her loitering outside a classroom or lecture theater, my smug letter in her hand, and a provoking expression on her face. But I went through my teaching day without seeing her. The following day was a repetition of the last. I worried that she might have killed herself. I dismissed the worry and went off to my classes. In the afternoon, I rang and got no reply. Dinner at a bar. Then I walked to her street and saw the white oblong of my treachery still in her window. At home, I debated taking my phone off the hook but left it on, by now almost ready to admit that I was hoping she would call. The next day, I had a section of the American literature class at 2 o'clock. To get to the building where it met, I had to cross a wide brick plaza. This plaza was always crowded. Students set up desks where you could sign petitions for legalizing marijuana or declare yourself in favor of homosexuality and the protection of whales. Students thronged by. In their midst, I saw Helen Kayon for the first time since the evening in the library. Rex Leslie was walking beside her, holding her hand. They looked very happy. Animal contentment encased them as in a bubble. I turned away from that sight, feeling like a Skid Row derelict. I realized that I had not shaved in 2 days, had not looked at myself in the mirror, nor changed my clothes. And when I turned away from Helen and Rex, I saw a tall, pale man with a shaven head and dark glasses staring at me from beside a fountain. The vacant-faced boy, barefoot and in ragged dungarees, sat at his feet. Greg Benton seemed even more frightening than he had outside the last reef. Standing in the sun beside a fountain, he and his brother were extraordinary apparitions, a pair of tarantulas. Even the Berkeley students, who had seen a great deal in the way of human oddity, visibly skirted them. Now that he knew I had noticed him, Benton did not speak or gesture to me, but his whole attitude, the tilt of the shaven head, the way he held his body, was a gesture. It all expressed anger, as though I'd enraged him by getting away with something. He was like an angry blot of darkness on the sunny plaza, like cancer. Then I realized that for some reason he was helpless. He was glaring at me because that was all he could do. I immediately blessed the protection of the thousands of students, and then I thought that Alma was in trouble, in danger, or dead. I turned away from Benton and his brother and sprinted toward the gate at the bottom of the plaza. When I had crossed the street, I turned around to look back at Benton. I felt him watching me run, felt his cold satisfaction. But he and his brother had vanished. The fountain splashed, students milled. I even had a glimpse of Helen and Rex Leslie going into Sproul Hall. But the cancer had melted away. By the time I reached Alma Street, my fear seemed absurd. I knew that I was reacting to my own guilt. But had she not marked our final separation by standing me up at the restaurant? That I should have been in a sweat for her safety seemed a final manipulation. I caught my breath. Then I noticed that the drapes in Alma's windows were parted, and the envelope was gone. I ran down the block and up the stairs. Leaning sideways, I could see in her windows. Everything was gone. The room had been stripped bare. On the floorboards, which had been covered by Alma's rugs, I saw my envelope. It was unopened. 6. I went home dazed and stayed that way for weeks. I could not understand what had happened. I felt enormous relief and enormous loss. She must have left her rooms on the day we were to meet at the restaurant. But what had been in her mind? A last joke? Or had she known that everything was over, had been ever since Still Valley? Was she in despair? That was difficult to believe. And if I had been so eager to be rid of her, why did I now feel that I was shuffling through a less significant world? Alma gone, I was left with the bare world of cause and effect, the arithmetic world. If, without the odd dread she had aroused in me, without the mystery, too. The only mystery I had left was that of where she had gone, and the larger mystery of who she had been. I drank a good deal and cut my classes. I slept most of the day. It was as though I had some generalized disease that took my energy and left me with no occupation but sleeping and thinking about Alma. When after a week I began to feel healthier, I remembered seeing Benton in the plaza and imagined that he'd been angry because he had known that what I had gotten away with was my life. After I started to meet my classes again, I saw Lieberman in the halls after a lecture, and at first he ducked his head and intended to snub me. But he thought better of it and flicked his eyes at mine and said, "Step into my office for a second, will you, Wanderley?" He, too, was angry, but it was anger I could deal with. I want to say it was only human anger, but what anger is not? A werewolf's? "I know I've disappointed you," I said, "but my life got out of hand. I got sick. I'll finish out the term as honorably as I can." "Disappointed? That's a mild word for it." He leaned back in his leather chair, his eyes blazing. "I don't think we've ever been let down so much by one of our temporary appointments. After I entrusted you with an important lecture, you apparently threw together the worst mishmash, the worst garbage." He collected himself. "And
You've missed more classes than anyone in our history, since we had an alcoholic poet who tried to burn down the recruitment's office. In short, you've been lax, slipshod, lazy. You've been disgraceful. I just wanted you to know what I thought of you. Single-handedly, you've endangered our entire program of bringing in writers. This program is supervised, you know. We have a board to answer to. I'll have to defend you to them, as much as I detest the thought. I can't blame you for feeling as you do, I said. I just got into an odd situation. I think I've sort of been cracking up. I wonder when you so-called creative people are going to realize that you can't get away with murder. The outburst made him feel better. He steepled his fingers and looked at me over them. I hope you don't expect me to give you a glowing recommendation. Of course not, I said. Then I thought of something. I wonder if I can ask you a question. He nodded. Have you ever heard of an English professor at the University of Chicago named Alan McKechnie? His eyes widened. He folded his hands. I don't really know what I'm asking. I wondered if you knew anything about him.
What the hell are you saying?
I'm curious about him, that's all.
Well, for what it's worth, he said, and stood up. He marched over to his window, which gave a splendid view of the plaza. I dislike gossip, you know.
What I knew was that he loved gossip, like most academics.
I knew Alan, slightly. We were on a Robert Frost symposium 5 years ago. Sound man. A bit too much the Thomist, but that's Chicago, isn't it? Still, a good mind. He had a lovely family, too, I gather.
He had children? A wife?
Lieberman looked at me suspiciously. Of course. That's what made it so tragic. Apart from the loss of his contributions to the field, of course.
Of course, I forgot.
Look, what do you know? I'm not going to slander a colleague for the sake of...
There was a girl, I said. He nodded, satisfied.
Yes, apparently. I heard about it at the last MLA convention. One of the fellows from his department told me about it. He was vamped. This girl simply pursued him, dogged him. La belle dame sans merci, in a word. I gather he finally did become enchanted with her. She was a graduate student of his. These things happen, of course. They happen all the time. A girl falls for her professor, manages to seduce him. Sometimes she makes him leave his wife, most times not. Most of us have more sense. He coughed. I thought, you really are a turd. Well, he did not. Instead, he went to pieces. The girl ruined him. In the end, he killed himself. The girl, I gather, did a midnight flit, as our English friends have it. Though what this has to do with you, I can't imagine.
She had falsified nearly everything in the McKechnie story. I wondered what else might have been a lie. When I got home, I rang DePizer, F. A woman answered the phone.
Mrs. DePizer?
It was.
Please excuse me for calling you on what may be a case of mistaken identity, Mrs. DePizer. But this is Richard Williams at the First National of California. We have a loan application from a Miss Mobley who lists you as a reference. I'm just running the usual routine information check. You're named as her aunt.
As her what? What's her name?
Alma Mobley. The problem is that she forgot to give your address and phone number, and there are several other Mrs. DePizers